Always Record, episode 148. The Bizarro Always Record team of Alex Fulton, S.J. Anderson, and Dennis Cook welcomes guest Kurt Hardesty. Enjoy.
Language. Whispering, shouting aloud. Food, drink, pulse, digestion, sweat, sleep. Walking, swimming, poise on the hips. Leaping, reclining, embracing, arm curving and tightening. The continual change of the flex of the mouth. And around the eyes. The skin. The sunburnt shade. Freckles. Hair. The curious sympathy one feels when feeling with the hand the naked meat of the body, the circling rivers, the breath, and breathing it in and out. The beauty of the waist, and thence of the hips, and thence downward towards the knees. The thin red jellies within you or within me. The bones and the marrow in the bones. The exquisite realization of health. Oh, I say, these are not the parts and poems of the body only, but of the soul. Oh, I say now, these are the soul.
I've been up for a long, since about 3, 4 a.m., so I didn't really talk about my complexities of my sleep issues, the full complexity in that email. But most of the time I sleep on Saturdays, I sleep in, but sometimes during my cycle I'm up really early. I just happen to be on that end of my cycle. But basically I cycle around the clock, you know, every 2 months or so, just like clockwork. And so it's a strange sleep issue, but
I am sorry to hear that.
As you know, I love it. But it's just, it doesn't work for things like, work, you know, things where you have to be consistent, but it's just sort of my natural way of being. But they call it non-24-hour sleep-wake syndrome is the name of it. And it's just a cycle that's longer than 24 hours. So, it's a little longer than 24 hours. So anyhow, it's been cool. I mean, I've learned how to be biphasal, which has been a real, thing I've enjoyed, you know, sleep 3 hours, sleep 4.5 hours twice a day.
Nice, the genius.
Kurt has played around with stuff like that too. So I was about to text you that you should bring that up to him because he's experimented with various other schools of thought about how to orient your sleep cycle.
Yeah, I figured he might have because it's really common in kind of like body training. I know. You talked about Wim Hof. He's mentioned Wim Hof. I imagine there's some crossover in those areas.
Absolutely. Yeah. He knows that territory really well. Yeah. That'd be funny to hear you guys share about that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Assuming we can locate him. I know he's about. Alex, did you get a confirmation from him by any chance?
I don't think so.
Huh. Let me see. I'm going to... add participants. Let me see here.
Yeah, I keep trying to add him. I add him, and then it says Kurt Hardesty has left the conversation for unknown reason.
Well, that's no good. Kurt never leaves any conversations, so I don't really understand that.
That must be, I mean, it's like immediate. Yeah.
I'm just.
It's not him.
I can, if you guys want, I can start a call with him, and I think I'll be able to add participants if I started the call.
Give it a shot. Give it a shot.
Okay, and then we'll call you guys back, okay?
Okay, cool.
Alright.
He has to use he's using his wife's phone, and he drove into town.
Okay. I'm going to try them now. Can you guys hear that ringing?
I cannot.
Okay. I think I'm... I got a no answer.
Is he having Wi-Fi issues?
He might, I don't know, he went into town to get a strong signal. He has to go, because he lives kind of outside. And,
oh yeah, he just texted me one sec.
Oh, okay.
One sec. So,
alright.
Okay, actually, and let me, we can just play this by ear. I'm not sure it was calling him, and I could hear that I was on two calls at the same time, so that was strange. But I may have to end this call if I get connected with him, and I'll call you guys right back if that happens.
That's cool. I'm sure he will figure it out. He knows what he's doing too. But that's weird that I don't know why it wouldn't let me add him. He's texting me right now.
Okay. Well, good morning to you, Alex. Are you just getting up? Just getting into your day?
Yeah. Just went straight from here to the coffee house to back here. So it'll take me a minute to get my bearings, but
okay.
I'll be awake and aware.
Well, well, thank you for working with us. Sorry, I
no worries.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
It's good for me to get up early. Early at 1. I don't normally get up later than this, but I got to bed a little later than I wanted to last night.
Do you just like to stay up into the night, or do you also work kind of late, Alex?
I work evenings, and then so it's kind of a vicious cycle. And I just, Eric and I are both night owls, so we just kind of stay up. It's just the thing.
Yeah, totally.
Mornings are kind of horrific. So we have the same kind of schedule, which is nice.
Nice. Yeah. I tend to stay up a lot later than my wife, but there's an alarm clock every morning when kids wake you up. So, so there's no real hiding around it.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I did not wake up early. I've been like this my whole life. I don't know what that says about my brain, but.
So did you see Star Wars, Alex? Yeah, you did, I guess. And so I know we were emailing. I wasn't sure if you had seen it. I was dropping spoilers in. There was like a lot of spoilers, but
yeah.
I guess you could.
Yeah, I saw it.
You had seen. Yeah.
No spoilers for me. I don't know about Dennis, though.
I don't care. Yeah, it can be spoiled.
It's really nothing to be spoiled. I mean.
Oh, sorry, Dennis. I thought you had seen it.
I don't care. I'm not, I actually probably will not see it for a while. So I don't care about spoiling it. It doesn't matter to me. So it's all good.
Okay.
Cool. Seriously, like, yeah. If you've seen the very first Star Wars movie, there is nothing to spoil because it's basically that.
That's what everybody keeps. Yeah.
I saw he had just defended that. It's like a Variety or Hollywood Reporter or podcast. And I just read an article this morning about it, and he's defending why it's so much like A New Hope. And he's kind of saying, well, we did that intentionally, you know.
Clearly.
Anyhow, I don't think it's a defense. But.
What do you guys make of that? I read most of it, and then I saw... I read most of it, I think. But what do you make of Lucas's comments? I mean,
white slavery?
Yeah. What's?
Well, I thought the double entendre, I mean, that's, you know, white slavery is sex slavery, and selling it, he says, I sold it to Disney, to the white slavers.
Uh-huh.
And so to me, it was kind of a subtle cue that, like, yeah, Disney is somehow a child abuse factory. Now, I don't know if he meant that or not, a sexual abuse factory, you know, of some kind. And, you know, given all the stuff about Disney or, I don't know. Actually, I don't know the specific claims other than the Hannah Montana stuff and the sexualization of children.
Yeah.
That's really the big thing I know about Disney's kind of, perpetrating maybe sexualizing people at a young age, but maybe there's other people that have information about, like, you know, there's the whole Hollywood network and we've talked about before. And Disney is kind of a stand-in for big Hollywood or the Hollywood establishment, but I don't have any specific, like, accusations of these Disney child stars were somehow in a white slave network or anything like that. That's a whole area of research. I'm not an expert on that. I don't study that very much. You know, I just hear about things like the two Corys and stuff like that. It's very general, you know.
Yeah.
But that's what interested me the most, because that term, I mean, he's got to know. Maybe he didn't know that that's what that term can mean.
That's why I wonder that too, but sometimes things end up meaning what they should mean, even though they, yeah.
Lucas, I think he plays dumb. I think he knows exactly what's going on. You don't get to be that rich without being privy to the upper echelon activities of people. Maybe he's being honest for once.
Yeah, I mean, could he not know? I agree. Yeah, I know.
Maybe he feels somewhat untouchable. But I don't know. I didn't really actually listen to the interview or really pay any attention other than his, just the headline of what he said.
And he is married to a black woman, so I think that there's a, maybe at one surface level reading, you know, that's also could be a part of it, that he's got, he's sensitive to racial issues and kind of the racial discourse, you know,
it
in
is,
a way that,
it is funny how he spent the past 15 years as like a full on, heel, to use wrestling terms, like a bad guy, villain, everybody hates. And then now, now that he sold the thing and he's sort of looking all sad, people are starting to have more sympathy for him, including myself, which is unexpected, but
I think we have a visitor. I think Kurt is here.
What?
Yes, you are, aren't you, Mr.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, Kurt.
How is everyone?
Good, good to hear your voice.
Well,
very well.
How are you? What are you? Where are you? I hear birds.
I'm just sort of walking around town, trying to find secluded areas so people can't overhear top secret conversations.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Exactly.
And not like walk out of the cell phone tower coverage either.
Kurt, do you want to talk about where you live now and just sort of its uniqueness at all? Or and also, you know, you should feel please give us, you know, this is obviously very informal and it's just a chat and all, but, you know, you have an interesting background and some of that might be fun for people to hear.
I currently live on the San Juan Islands, which is off the coast of Washington. It's this weird little, like, the states run a ferry thing. Otherwise, there would be, like, no way to viably live here. There's a bunch of rich people that have houses on some of the islands that they sail to. And then four of them are ferry serviced. And so it's this cool little, like, niche where the weather's too shitty for it to be like Hawaii, but they ship food in for you.
what's it called? What's the nearest
San Juan Islands. San Juan, it's crazy. I've never been anywhere like it in the country. It's definitely weird because it used to be like it still is. It's just a bunch of rich people and then a bunch of like anarchist seclusion hippie types out here. And all the islands have houses on them, but only four of them are ferry service and they run like six or seven ferries, a day. And it's like $50, but the thing is that then you get like a grocery store and stuff out here, whereas the other ones are just like off the grid mansions.
Yeah, cabins. That's weird.
And there's like a weird little underground scene because it's like it attracts a particular type. There's no, it's an island. It's crazy. It's like I don't know. It's really boonies, but you get infrastructure.
And you, Kurt, you've lived a couple different places around the U.S. and you grew up a couple.
I would say Seattle was like my formative years.
Yeah.
I was in Seattle for 10 years. Before that, I was in Ohio and went to Catholic prep school, swimming scholarship to Washington, did a molecular bio thing, and then worked in research for a while. And then that time in between, like, 2005 or 6, towards the end of college, is when I guess I would say I started, like, popping off of that track and getting more heavily into this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then I got into massage and whatnot just because of the movement thing, which has been doing the healing stuff, and then I've always been doing martial arts and all that. And kind of studying Qigong and whatever. I used to be a voracious reader, so like,
yeah,
I don't know, like 10 years ago I digested pretty much all of the mythologies, or a huge fraction of them, and then plus all the molecular bio, like, mythologies and all of the traditional sciences, I guess I would say. I'm pretty high trained in all the traditional sciences as a vocabulary.
You're a pretty wicked speed reader, are you not? I think.
Yeah. When I get going, I mean, I read all 6 or 7 of the Dune books in like a month.
Yeah, you were such a jerk about that because it took me forever to get through the first one, and he like did 4 books in the time that I did the first one. But
did you cultivate that skill?
Yeah, what?
Did you have to cultivate that skill, or did it just come naturally?
It was something I kind of did by accident in school when I was little, because I escaped into books and just hated, I mean, school was a game, so I would glitch it and make stuff up, and I accidentally kind of taught myself to speed read, because I don't know, it's just, you take in like a sentence or two at a time, so I can't digest poetry at more than like 2 or 3 words or 4 or something like that, because it's got meta. Like my own book, I can't speed read it. But but for like stories, Herbert's stuff is a little bit slower, but like for technical writing and the sciencey stuff, it doesn't really have the author's intent to layer meaning. Like they're just describing stuff. Like you can blow through that stuff at like 3 or 4 or 5, 6 sentences at a time as like words.
Yeah, seems like part of it, like, for literature and stuff, the rhythm of the prose would be somewhat lost if you're taking it in that chunks like that. But maybe not, I don't know.
Yeah, I wrote like a whole book where I was actually looking at myself read. And that's the whole thing of the book, is it's kind of like a it turns into a really recursive like guided meditation, but I'm sitting and looking at myself read and where you get the meaning from, and like we're reading all the time. Like if you hear footsteps, like you read that. You know, you read that pattern of vibrations.
Sure.
It's so like with the, I mean, it's there's some information there in the background of text, especially when the author is like channeling. There's kind of a physical object there, so you can. Some of it's more alive than the other stuff. Like the current science stuff is really, really processed food. And so it's really easy to digest, and it does like almost nothing for your understanding of anything. So it's like I can burn through that stuff the same way you can burn through like candy bars. And then the deeper the myth, or the more you want to extract out of it, it's like, it's the reading stuff's like really, I would say reading's like very mystical to me. Like I can, It feels like a antenna to the author, just a couple of sentences. Like you kind of use it as a meditation thing.
Cool.
I don't know.
I just wanted to ask where in Ohio you're from.
Cincinnati.
Nice. I'm from Richmond, Indiana. It's just a couple hours away.
Yeah, my girl, I went there because I did a long distance relationship with my college girlfriend, high school.
Was she from Richmond or?
No, she went to Indiana, so I drove out to Indiana quite a bit.
Nice. Midwest.
In another life. Midwest for life. Yeah. I run into Ohio people all the time. It's everyone either stays in the Midwest forever or they like think of themselves as like escaped convicts.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm in the latter category.
Well, Manson, right, is the classic escaped Ohioan.
Yeah.
Northern Kentuckian convict. that's what I think of. But, you know, and that whole region is interesting to me. I lived there for 2 months in 2012. I was working in Morgan County, which is in southeast Ohio.
Right.
And it's, you know, a lot of poverty with Appalachia. But then I read in Peter Lavenda's book about the mound culture. And I was living in Zanesville. I would drive down to Morgan County every day and I'd see these mounds. And, you know, there's just heavy duty mound culture in Ohio. I guess there's native burial grounds or native ritual places. But it's this idea of like, Manson came out of the area where we had sort of paved over the indigenous culture that was there before. And the consequences of that were kind of a Manson style, you know, serial killer. So I just find that interesting about Ohio. I don't know if you experienced anything like that there, Kurt, or if you, you know, seen those mounds or.
When I was, I didn't know enough to take in anything there at the time. I wasn't really interested in it when I was in Ohio. But yeah, the Native American technology stuff is very subtle.
Those mounds go into the North Iowa area, and we went there as a field trip once as a kid for my school class. It was kind of a trip. I've been wanting to go back up there at some point. Hey, Kurt, so remember when you started a school and I was in it?
Yeah.
That was fun.
Yeah.
That was a lot of fun. Do you want
to do that again?
What? Do you want to share a little bit about that? Or? Or what was your experience? Kurt started a school called the Cascadia School of Neural Kinetics, and we practiced and learned a bunch of stuff together, and it was a lot of fun. And in fact, you know, if anybody ever, I don't know if Kurt is still teaching or doing any teaching. Well, I know he is. So if anybody listens to this and cares to follow through and contact Kurt, I'm sure he would have a conversation and teach him stuff. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that was I would say that was kind of the birth of what I'm doing now, but it was as retarded as a baby coming out. I had this big flash of like, I don't know, suddenly like my molecular I perceived the molecular biology language, like in meditation, similar. It seems similar to like one of Tesla's flashes. And it was just how the cell, one of the ways the cell like generates energy, like how all the capacitive membranes like work is, I don't know, like giant. It's like a big AC circuit, like a three-dimensional squirrel cage induction motor is how I described it. And it like works with the nervous system. So this like big thing flashed together. And like from it was obviously like, okay, here's how this stuff works. And then you could kind of make these meditative tools and get better ideas about how the body works. So you could kind of exercise more efficiently. But it was way too complex to be like functional. Like I could have written tons and tons of books or all this other crap about how all the cellular machinery functioned, but it looked good on paper and it sounded good. And I think it even worked. And I would still say that it's true. Like you could design technology based off of it. And they have. But I found it to be not very practical for the actual goal of the school, which was to enhance physical abilities. Because it was like, it was just too heavy for an idea to enhance a physical ability. You have to like perceive the whole idea.
Yeah.
So if like you, with training or whatever, you could maybe work up to it, but you'd be seeing yourself as like a single cell or feeling it that way, or I don't know. But that's why a lot of the things are basically based off of elements and chi and weight and mass and fluid or something, because those are ideas about the inside of your body that you can like actually feel and shift around. So like a system to where I'm trying to teach movement and I'm using words like action potentials or resting membrane potential and shit like that. That might be what's happening like way, way downstream, but it's like so far downstream, it's useless as far as making you more powerful in the moment. So I kind of considered it a flop because it just started to, I don't know, it wasn't helping me all that much, and it started to get like really hypocritical and heavy. And I would say it was a really interesting meta experience to see how religions collapse and teachers collapse and other stuff collapses when the conceptual content gets heavier than the perceptual abilities of the people doing it.
Absolutely. Yeah, totally.
So I'm teaching again now, and it's breath-based, and I use those concepts, like the fancy ones, pretty much only to like rip apart the ideas that people have about their beliefs, because they're holding onto their ideas because they're fancy, like, oh, the muscles are tearing and actin, myosin, calories, and blah, blah, blah. There's this big scientific story, and people like that shit, and it kind of keeps them from doing, like, really, really basic exercises that would really, really make them better. So people come in with that stuff, and I teach, basically, it's the same stuff that a good yoga or qigong person's going to teach, but the molecular bio and the modern concepts of like physiology and even the like the chemistry of oxygen and shit going across the cells, like those words are so much sharper conceptually than any other, I think, systems that have come around in the English language, that it, I can kind of disarm people in a matter of like 20 or 30 minutes, and for at least a little bit they don't believe anything, like they think everything they know is bullshit. And then you can like load in the, let the chi and the breath or the prana like come up or relax or whatever. So I was kind of using the, I was sitting there like making swords for years and didn't really know how to sword fight. But like once you figure out how to use this shit, the modern mythologies are like incredibly like deconstructive. To the same level that they imprison people, like, you, if you shape it right, it, like, rips their logic trees apart. When you can get it to, like, fold back and contradict itself. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Sorry. I keep going. Just feel free to stop me.
No. Now, guys, we can go any direction here, and I don't mean to keep throwing myself in here. We could circle back to some of the things that we've discussed recently in conversation, or, you know, I know we had a really interesting, email conversation going on about, both. The whole, Nakamura and Komodo thing has been interesting to follow, the chess match, the man versus machine, which is sort of this cycle. Like, Alex, you should, I think Kurt is aware of some of this a little bit, but like it's like this is a cycle that's spinning again based on the Deep Blue stuff that you wrote about.
Uh-huh.
So no, like I'm curious what Kurt thinks about how this is repeating itself, and if this is just what is being illustrated in this reprise here, you know?
A quick question on the history of this stuff, because I haven't been keeping up with it. Did the like, I was keeping tabs when, like, that first computer beat the chess master and then it got more reliable. Was there ever a group of, like, new humans that could beat that first or second generation of unbeatable computers?
I think so, yeah. I think,
Or has it just been getting, like, more and more dominant over people?
You know, I don't know for sure. I'm pretty sure
the latter.
Well, I mean, it's gotten more dominant as the technology has improved, but I don't know if like, I'm pretty sure that the early engines like Deep Blue are pretty primitive compared to what's out there today. And I'm
right, but like, was there like a generation of chess people that could like easily beat Deep Blue?
I think
even
so.
Though Deep Blue's primitive.
I mean, I think all the people like Nakamura probably could. You know, I'm kind of talking out of my ass because I don't know for sure.
That's a great question. I'm not sure either. I didn't actually.
Has this pendulum swung back and forth, or are like the top 500 chess players all computers?
Well, no, that's the answer to that's very clear. Is that Deep Blue? I mean, since Deep Blue, there's been massive advancement on the computer end of this technology. Now humans don't stand a candle to the computers. I mean, in fact, like the last couple of years, all of the games, and in particular this Nakamura versus Komodo match that just happened, the 6th and 7th of January. Nakamura was given heavy advantages, heavy handicapping.
Right. Oh, so that's how they're doing it.
That's how they're doing it. And so Nakamura was down like four pawns, or the Komodo is the computer. He started down like two pawns, or started with a down a rook. I mean, yeah, but they're weighting it. And in this most recent case, Nakamura lost to Komodo even with the advantages.
Okay.
So it never swung back after Deep Blue. It's just more and more human handicap.
Just more and more human handicap. But incidentally, the game Go is the one game that the humans are still in control. And I think the computers have gotten better. But
Go?
You know, Go. We can go there. We can change the conversation to that if we want to go there. I'm not sure why. But they say Go is more intuitive. It's kind of like you were saying in your email, Kurt, and it's just harder to make an algorithm. That's the Chinese model. And if you're talking about Qi and Qigong, you know, I think that's a game that comes out of that tradition, you know, or is connected to that.
I think chess honestly used to be like that, and then it's like because we hacked it. It let the computers hack it, like on a basic level, because everyone just talks about. When I hear people talk about stress strategy, it's like, it's the same way that I have an intellectual debate with somebody. And I think back in the day, chess was like infantile strategy making ability, and then that would carry on instantly into like fighting, and it was, I think, a way to get you to. Make logical moves without thinking, like, hence the, like, speed chess. Like, it was kind of a tool for that sort of thing. And I see it developing that skill in people that don't get too nerdy about it.
This is, it's kind of where Bobby Fischer is very interesting, because he very much, deplored the modern state of chess in his later years, how it was all taken over by opening theory, where people would just, you know, memorize the openings, 7, 8, 9, 10, whatever, how many moves deep, to the point where it's not even like playable. It is people acting like computers, and he invented his version of chess, which is slightly randomized. There's that. Plane, I think. There's a chess 960, which is where the back row is randomized, which kind of makes it more interesting. But I don't know if that makes a difference with the computer technology or not. But I've always wanted to know, like, because in your email you're talking about people, you know, feeling the board, and I feel like Bobby Fischer was probably the biggest example of that in history. And it's always kind of interesting to know how he would do against a modern kind of machine or software.
Like, the way that our minds work like a computer really quick is through, like, variable compression. Like, we make quantum variables, like, really easily. Like, so they're trying to program whatever number of bit quantum computers. So, like, the average person's always by default paying attention to sort of about three things. and then they just put everything into those three categories. And then with training, you can start to keep track of like more and more things, and then like each one of those things is a bit, so it counts as a data bit in one set and another set. And when you start juggling like 12 of those, reliably, it just generates epiphany.
You know,
like on the board, if you could see the, like Bobby Fischer or somebody, instead of thinking about moves, is seeing like particular meta objects on the board and moving the meta objects around. And if you started to look at the board like two or three layers deep, I don't think a traditional computer could do anything to you, because every time it moved, it would be like pushing into like objects that you saw, like multidimensional ones. And you wouldn't have to think moves. You would just protect your objects in a way. Like it would look like a Rubik's Cube more than like, there wouldn't be any freedom for the computer. If you get my drift, like, that's like kind of how if the quantum things work, it works because it can turn like 10,000 bits into one thing, or it can split one thing into five.
Oh man, I think you just kind of explained something that I heard a long time ago that I didn't quite get at the time. And I'm sorry if this takes this into too much of a tangent, but one time that guy, George Kavassalis, told a story about this training facility where people would control, like start by controlling these robot crab things, like with their mind, or try to control one, and then you try to control five, and then you try to control 12, it like cycled up and it was like a teachable thing that I don't know, but it just sounds like what you said reminded me of that in a weird way.
You can do it with just three. Like I think I work at about five or six variables at most. Just basic exercises were to be able to juggle like around 12, and then that lets you kind of morph your like thinking or your meta objects into it, and then your body's one of those objects. So like if you're
doing it underwater, how would doing it underwater be changed that at all, Kurt?
Doing what, like chess underwater?
Oh, no, I don't, whatever. I mean, what is the dynamics of water? Would that actually, because when I heard this story from George Kavassalis, he was talking about it being done underwater, which I thought was interesting now that I remember it. But
how are these, are like robot crabs that they're controlling?
I don't know. That's what he said. But I don't know.
I don't know how to respond to
that. I know you don't.
Well, I wanted to say here, this is interesting you guys are bringing this up, because if you guys follow the NBA at all, you know, this guy Stephon Curry is sort of he's kind of emerged as this generation's dominant player. He's being compared to Michael Jordan, and he's this really diminutive guy. He's like 6'3", which is small for the NBA. But he's like a Steve Nash player, but he's breaking all kinds of records. He's doing things that had never been done before. And when you read about his training, he's got this special trainer, and all they do is what you're describing here, Kurt, is multitasking. They blindfold him. They just do things to push his body's ability to have inputs and do things simultaneously with different parts of his body. And so the training is kind of non-logical. It's not necessarily very, very often even basketball related. But
yeah,
once you put him back on the court, he's doing things that you are unheard of. And the other two guys on his team, one guy's a second round, he was drafted in the second round, and he's becoming a dominant player through the same training. And so, which is unheard of. So anyhow.
Watch him, he's moving in ways that other people don't. I mean, you can totally tell too. It's really interesting. Yeah.
So this is like a perfect example of what I mean by like the open, like the quantum thing is like the quantum computing, I'll call it, like the entangled bits is what makes it such that the biology really like can always start to outperform the created. And it's the, like, you know, like let's say that you can hold like five things at a time, which would be like your head and four limbs. And then you want to get better at your athleticism. It's like, okay, well, you dig into like what the hell that is, and you look at your arm, and your arm's got a hand with like five articulations of its own. The wrist, the shoulder joint has like five or six rotator cuff muscles. If you're like, you're not using any of that stuff. Like, if I said shoot the ball, you're not, like, actually going into your rotator cuff muscles and precisely contracting it to, like, guide the fluid pressure from your diaphragm out your arm into a whipping motion following your intent that's connected with the, like, you're not doing any of that stuff, even though that's, like, kind of what you have to be doing. So with the training, like, you go in and, like, you can do stuff like ground on the ground with your other, like your whole body except for like your left shoulder. And then you play with it like an infant, and all of a sudden you have the ability to see 5, 6, 7 variables in the left shoulder, strengthen all of those variables, perform dexterity, make them like coordinate with your eyesight, like whatever freaking games you want to do. And then you pack all that back into, that's just my shoulder variable again. And then pack all of that back into, that's just my, like, body variable. And then, like, then you, when you use your body variable, it's, like, quantumly entangled with, like, those past five variables that you had then. But you don't carry that with you. So, like, you can go in and keep, like, if you methodically unpack each concept, like, and the body concept's useful, then you can put in a lot more computing power into that, like, piece of data from the past via the training and make sure that you know that it's going to, like, resonate or do certain things in the future. So there's, like, an inherent, like, if you can see that picture, like, we have the ability to go in and train with that nuance and then get rid of it. So we actually, like, come back to the present without any of that processing power needing to be run to do that really complex, fancy-ass thing, which if you were going to have a computer do that skill, it would have to be running the shoulder program with all of its variables all the way out to the wrist, all the way out to the whatever, and run the body rules and run the game rules to, like, compete. It has to run all of that versus a human can practice, know and understand that, and then in the moment, they don't have to run any of it.
Yeah, it's real quick. The Nakamura Komodo chess match. When you read about one of Nakamura's strategies, he was making moves very quickly. The human was to try to force the computer into expiring on its time, because these were time moves. And so it was just what you're describing, Kurt, that the computer had to was sitting and thinking and doing all the hundreds and thousands of contingencies in its system. And Nakamura was just kind of moving quickly to try to, I guess, overload it or something like that. And it did work for one of the game. The game, he was able to draw two of the games, which is kind of a victory. And right. Then he lost two of the games. But with using that similar strategy, you're something similar to that. So.
See, I wonder if chess is like too small of a game. It might be like too rigid for this to work. Like it. Whereas that Go thing, like, once the variables get up, it gets way exponential.
Chess is pretty exponential, too. I mean...
That's what I've heard.
I mean, there's there's more possible chess games than atoms in the universe or something like that.
But can
something
you...
ridiculous.
So really, like, I wonder if the humans are putting themselves at a huge disadvantage by removing possibilities from the board, thinking it's a handicap.
Ah, yeah.
And then nobody's like, because nobody wants to try, they want the handicap.
It's funny because one of the games they gave him such a handicap, Nakamura. Some of the commentators were saying, is that going to hurt him for that same reason?
Right.
So, is it just too much where he's not going to know how to function because he's got too much of an advantage? And, you know, I saw that Bobby Fischer movie, that documentary that just came, or that biopic with Toby, and that was part of the thing. Little Toby Maguire, yeah, really, some history around it.
He was not particularly convincing.
No, he wasn't at all. But, you know, this game with Kasper, or who's the Russian that he played? The famous
Spassky.
Spassky, yeah. So this famous match, apparently one of the big game that was the breakthrough that showed Bobby Fischer's genius. He did some things like sacrifice a queen early. He did some wild moves that no one had ever seen. He basically got off the memorized openings very quickly, and Spassky didn't know how to respond. And so I think there is something to this idea of like breaking free of the grooves, the well-worn grooves that are kind of in the collective sort of realm of what is accepted knowledge. And, you know, it does shake people free. I'm not sure how a computer, you know, I think Go is, it's so advanced. There's so many dots on the board that Go does give the computer problems for that. And it's also the way the game is structured, like the flow of it. Like you can move all around the board and move back, whereas chess, I mean, you're advancing and only certain pieces can ever retake squares. I mean, pawns are just sort of advancing forward. There's an inevitable collision with chess that wipes out pieces. And I think Go, I haven't played, but is more of a flow game where you're flowing all around the board. And
I think that's actually it, because chess, I mean, if I'm just looking at it, it looks like it proceeds similar to an avalanche that you're like guiding, but it only, there's like no takebacks. Like you both kind of just go and crash down in the middle with the pieces kind of almost having, I haven't watched that many, but Go has more of a reverse, like you can like reverse time-ish, like kind of go back.
Yeah. Well, one of the structure of chess interests me because it's so very deliberate, and it mirrors, I mean, there's a whole book about how it mirrors the structure of DNA and the I Ching, because it's an 8x8 board with, I don't know, 16 different pieces, which, you know, I'm not gonna be able to rattle off all the similarities, but it is structured in the same way as the hexagram structures of the I Ching and the the DNA of like the codons. So that's just interesting in that something about that structure that produces finite complexity to some degree. And so the way it mirrors our biology seems significant.
I guess that's a really good lens into like what I was trying to talk about with how I read and how I think the guys are going to win chess, is that I think chess does not have that similarity to it, to the biology. I think chess is something else entirely, like something underneath the chess game, and our biology lenses and shapes that into its shape, and then we see a composite between our biology and chess, and so it looks like it has the same things. And so when people master it, it doesn't have that code anymore. They're like doing that blind sight thing where they're not looking at it through their biology. They only use their biology to find it. Like they kind of go to the game. Like it's like almost a very visceral, like physical, I think they call it, like I think Castaneda called it gazing. Like if you gaze the chessboard, you're going to like whatever that game is in the largest mythopoetic sense you could think of. You like physically go there, and then that physically makes your decisions happen here. But everything looks, I mean, everything reflects that code if you look into it. Like everything does. So like my assumption is that it's capable of looking at everything that we look at, because it's what's looking at it or what we're looking through. And then you see it pop up like all the time, and then studying it's great. Does that make, I don't know. Is that, that's kind of what I was trying to say, or that's how I feel the high level chessy stuff works.
Now, Kurt, would you say that that's what observing synchronicity makes it both interesting as well as both not interesting at all, because you're simply looking at the same pattern over and over.
Well, yeah, synchronicity is great, but like I was saying in the email, like bird calls are synchronicity. Me saying I have a gun in my pocket and a bulge like sticking out, that's going to be synchronistically tied to both the gun and my finger. And so it's like, you know, it could be real, it could be fake, it could be like, so syncs like,
yeah,
are definitely there, but like there's an intelligence behind it that can like have an intention beyond the sync. So like people are being fed syncs all the time, and then yeah, we're also seeing them, and like the conclusions, I don't know, it's like what can you do with that? And a lot of the syncs, it's like, well, the only thing you can do with it is sit in a chair and stare at a screen. Like a lot of the syncs, that's their practical utility. Versus some of the syncs is like, okay, I feel this person's like hand on my shoulder, and mystically I feel like this certain sensation of like gravity or weight in a particular way, and then that lets me like either shake their hand or throw them over my shoulder or do a cartwheel or something like off of their weight. Those are like, that's using synchronicity as well. And then there's like synchronicity that builds technologies of like these two things are linked together.
Could we discuss that in terms of the observance of false flag? Because I don't know. I think it would be helpful to look at that.
I'll get into that stuff, but like I just want to say like a little.
Quite a jump.
So here's the no, danger awesome. About any of this. Here's the danger about talking about anything beyond like the stuff thing's cool. We start getting into false flags, and then we start talking about world events that have only been reported to us. And so it's like, this shit is like cyanide, and your mental and physical performance goes down with every single belief that you have that's not true. And so like when we're talking about world events, I don't know, 80% true, 40% true, like where are the big lies, where are the tiny ones? And then, you know, you start these thinking cycles based on data that you're not sure about, and it's okay to like deliberate data, but then like when you're deliberating data with data that's not been it yeah. can get really energy consuming. It's basically that type of thing is what bogs down the quantum thing, is you throw at variables that don't resolve. By getting it to have like basically what I'll call open-ended perceptions. Like, it's like mental objects that you can't actually wrap your mind around. And then since you can't wrap your mind around them, they can't really be counted as whole or divided into two. And it just really clogs up the, insight.
So something very general could be said that it's interesting that more and more of these type of events are possibly occurring because of what that effect that has on the sort of the processing of
exactly. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I'm sitting here on the everyone's worried about these events and figuring things out, and it's like, you know, where does the power lie? It lies in the ability to direct objects, perceive events, and all this. And, like, if we're not thinking about any of that stuff and you guys wanted to notice, you could use a little bit of technology to tie yourselves together and notice sinks in your perceptual reality and start to observe all sorts of different energies and possibly form survival strategies based off of, like, what you know. And then possibly, like, form a good enough survival strategy to have some sort of physical independence from all this other stuff. And, you know, if you spend a lot of time studying this open-ended sink, it breaks that. It works like chafe or what, like flares out
yeah.
of a...
That's a good
out of an airplane. And I think the conspiracy stuff used to be like maybe something to get into, because it's like I think it before it was like people, we've gotten so outclassed on this particular realm, right? Like on in this particular stance, like our bodies have the ability to shift realms. Like everyone knows it who's done anything like meditation, psychedelics. Like you can change what you're standing on the same way that you can change your footwork in a fight. And we're like so dominated on this bandwidth that I think it used to be like these false flags could be thought about and you could discuss them like you would a feint or a fake or whatever. And but now it's like it's not being thrown like a fake. It's being thrown out like a jamming ray. So it's like basically all thinking from this position is kind of compromised. It, like the whole signal's been like just it won. It won right here, but it's a computer. It can't like move. Like, so you step to the side and suddenly the definition of what the AI is changes. The definition of what you are in relationship to it changes. Just like standing in front of somebody is different than standing on the side of them. So there's just so much stuff. It's like, yeah, there's a government that has a certain type of physical control things, and they do real things, and they buy off people, and they convince people of certain things, and they control things this way.
Yep.
Well, I just want to say, Kurt, I think it's a great point, and it's something I've been thinking about a lot recently, is this notion of where do we get the inputs that we are calling reality, that we take for granted as reality. And so, you know, media, narratives about government. I mean, when I think about my personal life, I haven't ever been around government at all. You know, and so it's almost wholly irrelevant to me. I mean, the post office, maybe. I think that might be a public-private partnership. But, I mean, I'm not anywhere near the halls of government. But yet, if I turn my phone on and go to my Google News app, that's what my experience is. It's like you're saying, sitting in a chair on a screen. I mean, my experience with things like government or international relations or any of these events that may or may not be true has come through this input of this words on a digital projection into my consciousness. And I think that is what, when you talk about a propaganda mechanism and you talk about, the weaponization of social media and of just media in general through the smartphone, to me, that's the key linchpin of why it is so effective, is that it takes people out. I mean, people have no direct experience with this stuff. I mean, and so they have nothing to judge or challenge the information they're being given against, because it's just not in their immediate space.
It's effective the same way that like a giant Death Star is effective. There's always like a little itty bitty shunt to the side that like negates like everything. Like it's like I was saying, like, okay, so my whole life I got dominated by believing scientific materialism and thinking I knew shit. This stuff entrains the perception, but when somebody, the instant that somebody demonstrates otherwise, like the person either has to die or shift. Like they either have to have a complete mental breakdown and lose control of their body or shift. Like, so the instant that narrative is proven physically wrong, and there's quite a few ways to do that. We have powers. Like you can vibe people into different states and stuff like that. And it's like, if people anytime anybody demonstrates that stuff, it breaks the narrative on a really, really deep level. And the only thing that comes out of these devices is narrative. Like, I mean, you shift to the side a little bit and people's mental body is physical. So everyone that's sitting there holding the gun thinking that they're like powerful in this particular way is vulnerable to, oh, right? Like, what's a clumsy way of doing that? You got all the EMF warfare.
Yeah.
Like those broadcasting antennas are primitive as fuck compared to like the broadcasting capability of any of the cell structures in the body. It's just a matter of like getting the energy to cycle through it. So like, you know, the people, everyone's wanting like a lab, like a really powerful lab so they can research and develop like weapons and stuff. Like you look at the particle accelerating capabilities of like DNA, the coiled the way it is, and like what different waveforms and frequencies it can absorb and then emit and all this other stuff. And you're looking at like electromagnetic warfare, and when it gets used on you, you get to feel it. So, I mean, a lot of this stuff that we're coming out with, like certain things are happening in people because they're being pressed on that way. Like your mind's being pressed on that way, and eventually you go, I've had enough. And when you press back, you press into the thing that was being dominated by, and it's like, we're absolutely crushed in that one position, which is great because you can push into and feel what's like crushing you physically. So I guess, it's
just from what I've, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I tangent. I don't
know. I'm just interested in this idea of waking up people, because I mean, my experience where I'm living is that, I mean, I've had to like go across the country to find friends that are even like-minded, you know. I mean, and I have good friends in Austin, don't get me wrong, but very few of them are, I guess, you know, you see
awake?
What I'm saying? And
are
so
we,
how do
are
you?
Are we awake? Are you and I awake first?
I'm open I'm awake to the extent I'm awake, but I know
right.
that my perception of the narratives, going back to the idea of the media representations, I feel like, is definitely not as, I hold less in common with my perception than I do with most of the people I run into around here. I mean, and they tend to share more in common with their perceptions, like, I mean, maybe that's just my particular milieu. I don't know, but I mean, I feel like, do you see what I'm saying though?
Yeah, I think we were in a conflict or a struggle or a process, and that perception point that, the perceptual level that we're having this conversation on is, it failed. Like that sort of base got overrun. There's not any real people on it. And I would say that when we're on this level, we're not awake. We're jacked in, which you can send and receive information on it, but it's not where you're going to find, like, it's not where you're going to find bodily safety.
Like, you mean Skype? You mean Skype or
no, I mean like the I'm awake and these people are asleep.
Well, I mean, I said I'm awake to the extent I'm awake, and I mean, I wasn't saying that there's a state of awakeness or asleepness, that there's a bright line, or that certain people are.
Well, no, I think there is. You said you wanted to find more awake people, though.
Anyhow, I mean, I want to get off on that tangent because I'm looking to find people that are like-minded, is what I said, and all that means is, I mean, they could be like-minded in a negative way or so-called negative way. I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I could find people that want to do, you know, maybe this whole, like you're saying earlier, a sink fatigue or a sort of, becoming inept as a result of, maybe not utilizing the information in the way that's useful. I mean, I'm open to that being what I've been walking into as well. So, but anyhow, going back to what did you mean when you said you want to snap people out of their belief systems? I mean, like, what people would you target for that? How does that come about?
I don't target anybody. I like just hang out, and then I do research, and then I have a period of time at the local fitness center where I like, basically, if people want to come and do movement research, I do it. And the only way that they're useful to me is if like they actually free up some of their processing power and like whatever. So they come in, and that gives the sort of consent to turn off some of their programs. And then like it's,
Which is an in-person thing can be done, right? Is that what you're saying, Kurt?
In person, yeah. You can learn stuff over the whatever. There's a vibe effect to where perceptions sync with each other. in the moment, like, you know, we emit vibes, and I mean, there's ways around distance or whatever, but in the moment, like where I'm still or active or whatever, it resonates with that part of the other person's body a little bit, and you can just feel it. Say, like, I mean, I've quote unquote stolen like so many movement secrets from like some of my teachers who didn't even really like me just from feeling that stuff. So it's, I would say it's like the main teach that, that's the like mind, I would say, is like when that's resonating, when the physical area around you is resonating in a productive way with the body, it's a like mind. You can, I don't know how masturbatory the technology is. I haven't gotten anywhere with it. I haven't. I've met one of my best friends found me through YouTube, and I found Dennis through YouTube. But I would say everything else is kind of like a disaster, and especially when I consider like, it hasn't worked, and it doesn't help what I think will help. Like there's like a limited use of like inspiration on it. Like I like finding, like the most recent things that I've say have been really helpful to me is Wim Hof, and then coming across or looking at Conor McGregor, and just realizing that what both of they're doing is possible, and then there's no other reason for them to. There's nothing else there after that. On the internet, like physically following people, so I don't. It's failed. It's been a giant failure thing for me, basically. I think I would be much further along without it. I'm open to that changing. So it's about as useful as cocaine, probably.
I kind of have a question. You said when you're working with people doing the breath work and stuff, and you can turn off program. So what does that look like when someone has that kind of epiphany or reaction?
It's the exact same as like massage.
Do they suddenly wake up and say, "Oh my God, 9/11 was an inside job"?
Oh no, I don't like that.
That was a joke. But you get the idea.
I don't know. Like I don't even know how I would approach that. I don't know if So if you're really interested in waking people up, the art and the skill of it is exactly like massage therapy, where there's knots in the body, which is like muscle tension or nerve processes or something, or fascial restrictions that actually eat up, block, or stagnate energy. So having the wrong beliefs about 9/11 is something that's, because it's creating a reality that's not real. The same way that kind of like muscle tension is creating a reality that's not real. You have to be able to physically feel and then press into those knots. And
are these literal knots or sort of?
Yeah, they actually can become physical. So let's just stay with the kind of muscles, because everyone's had like a decent massage or somebody's pressed on a knot. You go too hard and it actually reinforces the myth that you're trying to undo. Because the person like clenches up. And so you get into that thing that people call like, I don't know, whatever the psychic defense mechanisms people call, but it's basically like this person has to survive. And for them to survive, there's like a homeostasis system in the body. So their existence is, it's got a fulcrum around a false belief. But if you just go in there and like jab into it, the system's going to defend it because it needs that fulcrum to orient everything else. So if you just touch it, and you can touch it relatively firmly with permission, like deep tissue is like, I'm giving you permission to sink an elbow into this knot, and I might even be like screaming, but because of the consent, it's like still kind of eventually resulting in relaxing, even though that's a technique that's like falling out of favor. If you can just contact it, so that means like, I don't know if you wanted to convert it conversationally to like 9/11 beliefs, you, Stefan Molyneux is pretty good at this. You ask questions, you don't have the right answer. And so that's the same thing as like craniosacral or contacting muscular tension. You find it and you put energy into it without changing it. And when you do that, you don't press into it, so it doesn't physically change. The belief doesn't physically move because of what you're saying. Like you basically speak to somebody in such a way that speaking to them is going to be changing some of their beliefs, but it's going to be changing the beliefs that are healthy. So there's no defense knot around it. There's no argument. As you like sit there and like give attention to it. So physically that means like holding somebody's head and listening. So you're like touching it with as much force as you can without moving the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then that causes it to start absorbing energy. And at some point a phase shift happens and like it melts kind of like ice. And that melting process can include like past and present kind of melting together. So that's how you can like deal with traumas. So like as far as like deconstructing somebody's belief system, you basically pump them full of questions until there's like a phase shift. If you're skillful with the questions and the questions, you kind of get these relatively. Phone's being. Is that my phone or?
It was just for a second though. I think we're okay now.
You can kind of get like these relatively like mind blowing releases. Like I was flipping through a Sam Harris book in the bookstore, and he was talking about this guru non-dualist teacher that he went to, and the guy is so good at this that he points out dualistic perception and consciousness the same way that somebody would like show you how an optical illusion is fake on a page. Like, you know, a line with arrows pointing in, a line with arrows pointing out. Like, those look different, and you're just like, no, here, hold this up next to them, and all of a sudden the belief in those arrows being different sizes, like, just collapses. Just because you told them to hold a piece of paper right here. Like, in between them. So, like, 9/11's pretty, an interestingly tied up thing. What I would start to do if I was actually interested in pulling a person out of an incorrect belief about 9/11 is some generalized beliefs on like statism, some generalized beliefs on like what's their like morality and ethics, and at what point is it ethical to get somebody to support a society under the threat of violence. It's just directions like that, like really root questions start feeding a lot of slack into the system. And sometimes you'll get like a really spontaneous thing to where you get like a really good result would be that that person doesn't give a fuck about 9/11 and they start going towards breakaway societies. Like if you really deconstruct a person correctly, they'll like, you'll piss them off. If you do it incorrectly, they'll be like, oh my God, I've been lied to, and fuck those people. And if you do it correctly, they'll be, oh my God, this whole thing is a video game lie. And they go and activate their deepest whatevers. But all this stuff at like a mastery level, I know gets physical. Like, and when it gets physical, you're feeling, and there's like so much data flow, and you can alter that data flow with your feeling. And I think that's why you, like the Matrix movie metaphor is, he doesn't believe in any of that shit, so he's computing the whole matrix with his whole body. So his, like, code-changing ability is faster than anything that can happen. So it... But yeah, it's I don't know.
I hear you.
We're with you.
Yeah. All right. But that's my take on it, and I've started to feel that way much more strongly after getting into craniosacral work.
Yeah, I wanted you to elaborate on that. I wrote it down at the moment you said it because I know that that's been an important aspect for you lately. Do you want to bust that out a little bit more? What have you learned from it?
What is it? First of all, some of us might not even know what it is.
So craniosacral is like it started with osteopathic medicine, and the guy noticed that the cranial bones in the head move, the ones that we think are fused, and they kind of breathe. And one thing leads to another is he's researching this and he's like seeing that the bone movements impede certain health. And like if they're stuck, it causes certain things. And then there's like a fluid flow that goes up and down the spine. And these doctors are like, oh, if we palpate this and kind of, you know, they're sitting there with these pretty complex understandings of anatomy and physiology. And then they're feeling their patients like relatively deeply, like their palpation skills kind of going through the roof. And I would say that was the first time in Western medicine to where you had doctors who were studying both anatomy down to like the cellular fluid level and working on their perception or their palpation. And the sacrum breathes this way too. So there's kind of a tide that goes up and down the spine. And the head inflates and then deflates, and the sacrum kind of inflates and deflates as it washes back and forth. And you know, as the inventor of it got more and more into it, his background. I was reading a book. It kind of seems to be a little bit like what I was saying, where I had this like big top heavy flash of insight about everything. And then all of a sudden you're like, it's too complex. So over time, there's a lot of different schools and thinking patterns of like craniosacral that were, I guess, they sprung off of the same guy depending on who was learning from what age in his life. So in the later years, it got way more mystical and he's basically palpating like what he called the breath of life, or hopefully not palpating the breast. And then fixing that, and they're finding that you get all these like birth traumas and these childhood traumas and stuff, and it makes the body freeze in these panic responses, and it limits your function as all these old programs accumulate over time. You get weak and stiff, and it robs your organs of energy. And as a therapist, it's just Reiki. As far as I can tell, it's the same thing. You're just holding somebody's head, and lo and behold, your perception has healing power, especially when you focus it with the mantle of I'm a craniosacral therapist and you're my client. That focus, that makes it a more sacred thing. Or
yeah,
I've been practicing this for 10 years or whatever. And it, you can put on all these clothes that suddenly your hands are about as powerful as the aura of a high level Swami or whatever, even if you're still, you know, somewhat of a shithole. And so like you can sit there and hold somebody's head and you feel their body breathing on all these different levels. And there's a couple different levels of the tide and each one of them gets deeper. But you can hold somebody's head and feel where the you could call it fascia, or everyone has their own language for it, but you can feel where like people have neck injuries when they're 12, and you can go back and like see it, like witness it as it unravels itself. The like the code or the information still in there, and it all you actually put attention into any object, and it's like leaving ice out in the sun, and if you leave it there long enough, it's gonna melt. And it's different from other massage therapy, or at least I would say, less conscious massage therapists are like trying to change the tissue at a higher level of energy / body work. It's kind of like, yeah, you're trying to change the tissue, but you're trying to change it by putting, by dumping energy into it, not ripping the objects apart. Like when you do the whole, like, I'm accepting the situation as it is, or I'm accepting the head as it is, or whatever, and you get deeper and deeper into it, it's literally dumping it. Like listening to it causes your body to resonate with it. And then you can look at that as pouring energy into it, or suddenly you're donating your processing power to it. And then it gives it a chance to resolve its own issues. So you're kind of like saying that you don't have an agenda, and you dump energy into the person and say that their innate healing wisdom or whatever, or their innate whatever knows what to do. It just, because of the injury, it doesn't have enough energy to fix itself. But once fixed, it might have enough energy to sustain itself. So people are doing that with Reiki, as far as I can tell, but it's like totally undirected. So the results are less measurable, because the Reiki is going after the healing of the whole person, which if you're really going in there with no agenda, the person's highest good might mean to get sick and die. Or it might mean that they need to get worse first. Or it might mean like they need a different job. So you're doing Reiki on them and their job changes, their cancer get worse, they almost die. You can't really evaluate it. But with the craniosacral stuff, you're like using all of these words and these concepts that I've thrown out there to focus the energy, and it tends to kind of do what you want in a measurable way, even though you're being very permissive of how it accomplishes it. Like, it's this very cool middle ground between true energy work, which is so open-ended, there's no way to verify it, because you don't know what the energy wants to do on this big cosmic scale. And like the ego level, to where it's like, I have a freaking knot in my back and I don't want it there because it gives me headaches. The craniosacral kind of like makes a whole world out of the knot, and then lets the energy do whatever it wants. And you can kind of watch it. It's still hard to scientifically, like, whatever. I can't say as like a therapist, I'm touching somebody and like, oh, it feels like we're spinning because I just fell off my bike and now I have a concussion and my brain's throbbing and the client's dizzy and did we heal anybody? I have no idea. It's bizarre.
Whoa.
You know, I didn't want to interrupt you, but one thing that came up on a conversation I'd had in the past with SJ and Alex was people drilling in their heads. Have you ever heard of that? You know, where people like drill under their skull?
Trepanation.
Yeah. You know, like once you start using any of your organs more like a, I don't know, you kind of like once you start using it as a tool, which means like going limp with it. You know, like they say, like go, like get loose to like throw a good punch or whatever. You're letting go of your arm tension so that you can actually just throw your whole freaking arm at him.
Yeah.
You can kind of do that with any organ. Like once you let go of it, then you can pick it up and kind of put the whole human tool using skill to use, which means that like the brain and the skull and the kidneys are, they don't have a function. They're as multifunctional as like a piece of iron. So the head boring or drilling underneath it, like you crack open the skull and it's gonna tune into certain energies better. So it like depends on the culture and all that, and if they know how to use it. And I was stretching before this call and I had my ear on the floor like doing some weird shoulder stretch. And I could hear the people talking in the room below the floor. And if you lift your ear up off the floor at all, you know, you can't hear them anymore. And so it's like, it was an interesting example of like, if you jam your sense organ into a perceptual thing, you can kind of use the whole, like the whole floor suddenly was my ear, because I shoved my ear into it so hard. So I would imagine like drilling into the skull and stuff like that would allow certain mental abilities to flourish easier that would normally require that you like jam your mind really hard into your like boundaries.
Yeah.
But with a hole in there, then it would, you know, you're kind of cutting a, you're cutting a hole in the floor. Is kind of, it's like structurally not a good idea, but you can definitely listen to the people down there a little bit easier. So I think that's kind of what it's for, but it's hard to say because people have been, people are creative. So these bodies have been used in lots of different ways.
Yeah.
I think we were talking about it also more in the context of like it being done to people as kind of a programming strategy, not necessarily as people, an elective trepanation for some kind of expansion of abilities or something. I mean, right. Isn't
that? Oh, that, I mean, same exact thing. Like, all of a sudden, like those people are, can be like yelled at.
Yeah.
You know, like you, and like you yell at them really loud and they're going to obey. Cause it's like the, this, you can put a suggestion right into their little holes. I don't know. I'm pulling that out my ass. So I don't know anything about it, but I'm just like structurally from how I know things works. So that's my guess is what's going on there.
Yeah, I guess trepanation has a history of like as a medical procedure. I just quickly looked at the Wikipedia page, or I saw a Google search, and there was a skull that had a big hole in it. And I imagine, I'd never heard of that term before, but it reminds me of bloodletting, like some sort of antiquated.
I think it's one of those things that's been speculated that there was a use for it long, long ago. But I think it misinterpreted potentially. So,
I think bloodletting is about as modern as any other healthcare thing.
And me too, man. You got. Oh boy.
Kurt, now okay. I on my list of things, I have several things. Now, you and I have talked a lot about CERN in the past, which. Who doesn't love talking about CERN?
Yeah.
And then, you know, you actually finished most of the Dune books. So, that mythology, I think, is particularly interesting, like different races having different abilities within the context of the Dune universe. And then obviously, I don't know, we've kind of danced around AI. We haven't really gotten into it, the meat of it, like we have in some emails. So I'm just throwing those three things out. If Alex and SJ have any other,
those are pretty tied together. So we could probably hit all of them if somebody wanted to choose an entry point.
It's what is it? CERN AI, and what was the other one there, Dennis?
One? CERN AI, the Dune universe.
Dune universe. I've not read Dune, but I'm certainly I've seen that Jodorowsky's Dune documentary, and so I know about it from that.
We could just call it the mythopoetic ability.
Okay.
Dune's amazing, but like regardless if you've read it, the guy just did a very good job of what a lot of people have done.
Yeah.
I just know in that documentary they talk about, like, I am Paul, is that the character's name? And he becomes sort of like a this all-encompassing entity. There's a sense of interconnection of all things through some kind of Jesus-like transfiguration or something like that.
Well, Herbert's...
Is that the theme?
The cool thing with Dune is that the main character of the book is... I mean, the story arc is about, I don't know, 7 or 8 books. And he didn't finish them, but his son, he didn't finish the story arc, and actually, his last couple of books, you could tell he was just, like, senile, like,
yeah,
reading them, you kind of feel, you almost feel, like, violated, because they're so terrible. And, but the, you know, this, his, it's just the writing that falls off, like the mythos is still good. It's just, he starts to just become a dirty old man.
And then his son has wrote books with who, right? The guy that wrote the
Kevin J. Anderson. Yeah. He's like a Star Wars author, and some other stuff.
Which is,
and they wrote the books based off of, Herbert's original manuscript, which they found like 10 or 15 years after his death. So they wrote the books to finish out his vision. They weren't like just making shit up. Like, so the books have, I actually enjoy Kevin J. Anderson quite a bit. So I like, I almost like those better. Herbert did 3 good books and then he went crazy. And then his son finished it out pretty well. But
is that, is the mythos, I mean, this I am Paul thing, I'm just, is that what it is? Is this,
well,
the character?
So in the main one, you get the Paul character who turns into the, you know, he's the royalty disowned, turned into mystical messiah type person, saves the day, unifies the planet, starts a giant fascist religion around himself, sort of hates what he's becomes, ends up losing control over it, becomes a prophet against it. Then his son picks up the mantle, becomes like an even larger tyrant. And so he's got this story arc that goes like 10,000 years based off of like the same characters. And then the main character of the entire, like,
yeah, the Duncan Idaho
series is this Duncan Idaho dude who you don't even hardly notice in the first book, but he's the character who the whole series was about. So, like, I don't know.
He gets, like, reanimated through this sort of weird reanimation process.
He was the only one that, like, didn't try. Everyone else had these, like, different methods of immortality that they had devised. And this guy just kept getting brought back into it over and over and over again. Anyway.
Have you seen this, Alex? By any, out of curiosity, or read these books, Alex?
No, I don't know a whole lot about it. I just know about the spice.
Yeah, the spice, which was based off of mushrooms, I guess, for him.
Hmm.
But it's just, when you dig into the books, it's like, it syncs up with, a lot of how the body functions as cells. So you got these, you get all these different main like races and classes of power, and it's like, the hyperspace, the people that are like in control of like holding space so that the galaxy is connected together, have all these characteristics of nerve cells. Like they're isolated, they float in special gas, they like travel without moving, they like do all these. I mean, you would have to kind of have this. It's just interesting that the book, all of these gestures about the planets and everything, like basically capture the workings of like cell structure and body function.
Is that intentional, do you think, or was it just a synchronicity?
It's that thing back to like, it's the only thing we can look at. So when an author gets like really in the flow, they're getting a really good glimpse of their imagination of what they're actually doing. And the framework underneath that is the body. So the same way that you get that 64 base pair codon thing and everything you dig into, all these mythopoetic structures mirror perception, or they mirror like cell structure, or they mirror whatever, because that's the thing that's looking.
It's funny, because we talked about the tarot and its relationship to the body on one of the recent shows.
Yeah.
And so it's just another example of what you're describing there, myth of, you know.
And
the body.
I think these things are cool, and this, it's kind of what I do a little blurb on this in my book about the magic of a mirror. So anything that's being recursive, or even when you notice it's being recursive, like, so you get this like Zen koan where it's like, okay, the mind is this mirror that reflects everything. And I want to see the mirror, but it has no edges to it. So how the hell am I going to do that? Everything I look at is this thing. So like, if you get a mirror and put like it doesn't have to be the original mirror, but just like another mirror at the point of reflection, because the main whatever the main thing is doing, like the mind's reflecting. So if you look at anything else that's reflecting, you might not be seeing the mirror, but you know it's its location, like it's right there, because you're seeing reflecting. So like in a mirror, you physically know your consciousness is there. So when these people are doing these like recursive, like mythopoetic things where they're looking at their imagination, like with their body and like writing it, it gets you into these like, it's synchronicity, because the author, I'm fumbling with this, but it mirrors it, and then it gives you insight, because it's like right there is it's what you're doing. So it puts you in the proximity of the event in your body. When Herbert wrote about the real thing happening in his body, no matter how he wrapped it, when you read it again, it's bringing you to the event. Same thing with like the Matrix or any of these, or like whatever, the ones that seem to be mirroring the perceptual loop or the hero's journey or the things like Star Trek, and the whole thing about all that shit out there is almost always like, it's always different, slightly versions of the same species, which is what your body is. It's like all these different cell types that all look radically different, but at their core, it's like every single one of them is still human. Even though some of your nerve cells are like 6 feet long and like incomprehensible, and some of them are in contact with like you, a meta intelligence. Like your lips are moved around almost exclusively by like this weird elusive god of the entire body. So like when people are, you see there's like all this opportunity for like myth making around all these different relationships in the body, and then when people write on that really well, it even if you don't get it, it at least puts you in the presence of that thing, the same way that when you look at a mirror, even if you don't get that mirror is doing exactly what your consciousness is doing, and therefore at the point of that mirror where the reflecting is, like that's like physically right where your mind is, even if you could never possibly see it, you know it's like right there, like you can touch it. Even if it's impossible to see it, it's like you've physically located it, you've like gotten into the presence of it, which is like, that's how temples and stuff work, where it's like you've got a statue of the deity, you hold the deity in your mind, the statue is creating this kind of like reflecty thing, and then while the actual deity could never possibly show up in this realm, just like you could never possibly show up inside of your own body, the attention of the organism or the attention of the god is called there. So like the myths or the reflections call the attention, Voldemort. So that's what like Herbert's thing was, like using the sci-fi language to just craft this. He crafted a thing in science fiction that I would say has as much depth. He saw as far into himself imaginatively as scientists have seen with like 1,000x electron microscope. Like that's what I would say was like brilliant about this guy's like vision, that on his own he pierced that deep into reality. And then the Dune mythos is kind of what popped out of it. And it sinks like all the way down without repeating, because a lot of this stuff like repeats. So if it does that fractal thing, then you know you're looking at just more, I guess, recursive guessing. But like his storyline is like 10,000 years, and it kind of like cycles, which is akin to changing. It just changes scales. Like, a lot of people, it's like, what's inside the body? More teeny tiny bodies. And, like, his thing really was, like, okay, here's the main myth. I'm going to dig into that. And there's, okay, that's a cell structure. That looks way different than the animal. I'm going to dig into that. And it's like, oh, that's a DNA. That looks way different than a cell. And I'm going to dig into that. and there's atoms or string, and that's way different than DNA. So, like, in one myth, he had, like, this, it was kind of a layer cake like that. And I've not really run across anything like that outside of, systems that were formed by, like, hundreds or thousands of people and technology or something like that. You know, like, Buddhism or whatever has mythos that goes that deep, but it took them forever. It was like, this was just one dude, like, going off. And, like...
How would you compare him to someone like Philip K. Dick, who also...
I have not read enough Philip K. Dick to have a huge... thing, but from brushing into Philip K. Dick stuff, he was
he was
more focused. He was more like this. The story's like huge. It was like just an intense. It was like a Hubble Deep Field,
right?
With Herbert versus Philip K. Dick. As far as I know, it was like. He would take these awesome snapshots. In a way, it was like Herbert's thing was like a really like long exposure. He really thought about the exact same story, and like kept channeling it. He wasn't trying to like extend it. You could tell it was like this was the picture, and he was going to resolve as much of it as possible. It kind of thing, but yeah, I want to read them again because it's interesting, and I have a hunch that the ones that I'm saying are like really crappy might have some golden nuggets in them, because I've had that reversal a couple times about stuff that was over my head.
Sure.
I don't know. I guess that's okay. So that's everything I think about Dune.
I haven't seen it yet, but I think that from what I've heard, that new Star Wars movie reminds me a lot of some Dune stuff. So I don't even remember what element of it, but yeah. That's why I'm curious about his son and the Star Wars guy linking up in real life. So it's like these two mythoses being intertwined into...
Wait, Herbert's son linked up with the...
Well...
Kevin J. Anderson.
The Star Wars guy.
And Kevin J. Anderson. Oh. I thought you meant with like J.J. Abrams. I was like, what?
No, I don't know about that, but yeah.
Walt Disney. Anyway.
Walt Disney is just another Duncan Idaho, though, Kurt. I'm sure he's been reanimated as well. So.
Right, exactly. All right, I guess how do we get into the AI thing? I don't even know where to start with that.
I don't know, and I don't mean to be a buzzkill, but I have about 10 more minutes before I have to leave town. So, but should we do some AI chat?
Yeah, 10 minutes is plenty of AI. It's not even it's not healthy to think about AI longer than 10 minutes.
Obviously, Kelly and Alex can bother you for longer than that. I don't mean to be the one that blows it all up, so.
Yeah, I have 35% more battery, and I have to charge the phone more, which I have a charger, so it's not a huge problem, but... I don't know where to start with the AI because it's like it's kind of related to everything. So
maybe I could just jump in here and just maybe you can just start by breaking down.
Is that my phone scratching or what's?
Yeah, I'm hearing some scratching.
It might be
some breaking up.
A little.
Somebody's microphone brushing up.
I'm trying to keep it still now.
Yeah, I just muted. I guess if it's not being used.
It's gone. Okay. It's gone now, Alex.
Okay, cool. It's working. Sweet.
I was just gonna say, a good place to jump in might just be, kind of breaking down what we mean by AI, and just sort of going into kind of what that is and trying to define it a little bit. I think that would be a really useful place to just start. And, you know, I'll just start off by saying I think one of the conventional definitions that I've read in some recent news articles, at least I was referred to like in finance news and economic news, is computers being able to do things that humans used to be the only be able to do. So it's computers learning skills and then executing actions that were formerly in the realm of humans only. And that's one kind of definition. And that may kick us into a whole conversation and other ways of looking at it and anyhow, so I'll throw that out there to the floor.
So we've got like AIs, which is something that seems to like automatically process data for us or something. Is that?
Yeah. Like, oh, no, I think it could be, it could be anything, right? So it could be computer workers at the grocery store. I think that's, you know, it could be, you know, self-checkout technologies. It could be, you know, I think it's a pretty broad, the definition, as I understand, it's quite broad. But I mean,
what about RNA?
What is RNA?
What about RNA versus like DNA?
I'm not a biologist, and I think I've taken one biology class in eighth grade. It was the last time I hit that topic. So you're talking to a real sophisticated person. Remind me what RNA is again.
Well, we've got like, if we're going to use the biologist thing, you've got your genetic code, which kind of reproduces and goes forward through time, and then it basically churns off code, like streams of logic, like single-stranded. It can't replicate. It's created. It's created by that cell at that time. Versus the DNA is kind of like, did it create the cell or like where did it come from? It just kind of goes through the lineages. So to me, like the AI seems to, like we've got all sorts of helper things going on already running our body, like cellular machinery. If we're not controlling it, like kind of what is? The same way like at the checkout, if we're not sending ones and zeros back and forth, if we're not sending the data back and forth, like what's doing it? And to me, that seems to be the job of the AI.
Well, and I think in that context, I mean, the conventional answer would be a programmer coded program, and that's what allows like the checkout to give you the correct change and to send your payment to, you know,
right.
So, I mean, you know, I guess, I mean, in the context of more conventional definitions, yeah, you have human coders. But, you know, I guess what you're raising is there, let's set aside technology in the 21st century, let's just, even electricity, let's go back to like 500 years ago. You're kind of asking the question, is there an AI a type of AI or something that we could call AI? That's running programs in our body.
Yeah.
So is this more of a mystical kind of spiritual question of like maybe there was something that coded the biology?
No, it's more of a let's define humans. Like,
yeah.
At what point, and where's the human and where is the excretion of the human? Like, where's
Real
the
quick.
Human and where is the matter that the human has coded or manipulated?
I wanted to kick this to Dennis real quick. I know you got about 6 minutes, Dennis. Do you have some thoughts on this?
Well, no, I like where this is going because I think that the definition of terms is really good. But I also think that, and I actually don't think that you're either one of you is saying the different thing. I think basically what we're just saying here is that the degree of machinery is inherently the same thing as the mystical component. So like, just the, de- the degree to which we're examining the mechanics is, I think, maybe what Kurt's getting at.
I'm trying to relate it to, I'm trying to get it so that we can actually think about it, which means, like, feel it. So you look around the room or at the computer right now or wherever you're sitting, and you know for a fact that this is, like, the image of the world that you're putting together, like, you know, factually, is you're looking at your body. Like, on the inside, the photons are going in your eyeballs, and that's causing something to move around or wiggle in a different way than it was before. And you're reading that wiggling, and then you're forming a virtual reality simulation of a computer or a chair or whatever the hell's going on. Like, does anybody disagree with that?
No, yeah, that's, yeah.
I mean, I guess my only, I wouldn't say disagreement, but it's just, it's a question of being able to have a conversation about it, because I feel
well,
like...
Well, just trying to locate us, I guess. Locate us in we have to, like, know where the AI is taking place, because it's such an ephemeral thing.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do, and I just feel like that's why I bring up the conventional definition, because I think where we're going is fascinating. I love this question of what does it mean to be a human, and who are we, and what is consciousness vis-a-vis the body and perception? I just think it, for me, using the term AI to describe those more innate biological process, I guess I feel like we could use other terms like non-computer AI or something like that, just to be clear. And then it will help us to relate it back.
Do you want to dig into should we limit it to modern day technology AI as related to, like, the internet type thing, or would that?
Oh, I think both are relevant and they're both key. I mean, I just, for purposes of the discussion, I get confused when we're talking about the internet and then we kind of go and start talking about AI in a context that maybe from the conventional understanding doesn't make sense, I guess is what I'm saying. And so if we're just clear in the discussion where we're saying, well, now let's talk about how, like, the body processes may mirror or emulate the computer AI process, just so there's a distinction. And even that the distinction's false, for the purposes of the discussion, I think it would just be clearer, you know. And we may ultimately conclude it's the same AI. I mean, if you want to posit that, I'm down with that. But what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think what I'm trying to do, so at first when I was, like, talking about the All Right Anything, was to do one of those recursive mirrors. So I'm, like, I guess if you want to know how I work with the conversational thing is that I try and get the conversational, like, recursive so that we're in the presence of the thing, and then it will speak through us. So, like, the easier way to set up that mirror is if we kind of realize that this, you know, you hold out your hand in front of you and you're looking at that, you know that the hand is an idea inside your mind. Like, you know the photons are going in your eyes. They're changing the action potentials in your brain. They're causing some sort of weird vibrational difference in the body. You're reading that vibrational difference. And then, bam, holographic projection comes up because of the vividness of the reading. Like, I think that's a relatively factual recursive thing to say, that when we're talking about the computers or the AI, this is an event that's happening in our cell structure. It's the thing that's happening, like, inside the body. It's an electromagnetic phenomenon. It's a vibration. It's an event inside the body just as much as the heart is inside the body, or plaque, or blood, or, like, whatever. It's something like that. And it's, like, it's... That's kind of the relation point when we're looking at these things. The other way to look at it is to say that to find the AI in, like, this other process of, like, oh my God, all the proteins that I make are, like, scripted sequences made by other scripted sequences that I'm spitting out. like doing stuff that's like really similar to the computers. Or when I draw like two dots and a smiley face on a piece of paper and show it to you, like what told you that was a smile?
Well, I guess where's the artificial come in is where my kind of question is
created.
Like
created.
But I mean, at a certain point, there's a not like artificial only has meaning when it's held against something that's non-artificial.
Right.
And so if you're making the claim that everything is artificial, I'm down with that. I just want to be
not
clear.
So
what is the non-artificial intelligence then was what I would throw back to you. Like if the body is artificial intelligence and the processes of perception and biology are artificial intelligence.
The non-artificial it's like the big mirror. It's kind of black. It's kind of mysterious. You can physically locate it though. So like DNA is an interesting, like I would call it the location of the non-artificial intelligence, even if it is created, because what it does is it projects out reality and is changed by reality and moves forward through time, replicating. It's not the only thing that can do this, but it's like the main player that we're with, because like RNA can kind of do this in viruses, but not without the help of the DNA. So you get this at this very core fundamental of like layer of ourself. You find this like creator created dynamic, and there's a little bit of a conflict, because what happens, like the RNA, it creates all the proteins, all the cell structures and a bunch of other crap, and it also regulates the whole body. So without like awareness, all of a sudden the body can become regulated by its own creation. But the RNA always degrades. It never like, it does not outlive the body unless it's doing something like a virus. And so it's the same thing with computers. Without people here using the computers, or without somebody that's been trained to even recognize the AI, it doesn't exist. It doesn't go forward through time, and it doesn't replicate, even if it is currently like regulating or controlling us. And it can get really big looking, like a global Skynet or something, but it's like, it's got that same resonance thing. It's everything that we're not doing automatically. So like a lot of people, it's like, it's the autopilot, and you can make the autopilot really intelligent. Like if you don't want to take care of your personality, you can just become a cliche. That's I mean, right there. You're looking at people that are running a particular level of an AI. It's like anything that they're not doing, they're letting like, they're like this cell that spat out a bunch of culture, and they're letting the culture dictate how they dress, behave, eat, sleep, mate, whatever. And so it's like we.
Bye, Dennis.
All right, yeah, I gotta run. Kurt, I'll chat with you later, and Alex and SJ, as usual, good to hear you guys. So.
Hey, you too. Have a good trip.
Likewise.
Keep up the good chat here. Sorry, I'll catch it on the flip side.
All right, until next time.
Bye, guys.
Elvis is my daddy, Marilyn's my mother, Jesus is my bestest friend. We don't need nobody, cause we got each other, or at least I pretend. We get down every Friday night, dancing and grinding in the pale moonlight. Grand old I pray, we're feeling alright. Mary, praise the rosary for my broken mind. So don't worry about I sing the body electric. Friend.
Heaven is my baby, suicide's a father, opulence is the end. We get down every Friday night.